Welcome everyone to another episode of Radio Free Nintendo. This is 393. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are James Jones.
What are we doing?
John Lindemann.
I don't know, James. I have no idea.
That's normal.
Guillaume Veillette.
Just making fools of ourselves, as usual.
Pretty much. And joining me right next door, right next to me, sitting right here, is our good friend, my brother from another mother, who is also tall and skinny and wears green a lot, is the younger plumber himself.
I am nobody. I'm nice to be here. Hi.
Did you forget his name?
I'm Michael Cole.
His name is the younger plumber. I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, you forget about the Luigi.
Oh. No, actually,
we are
what happened
certainly
is...
off on a foot for this episode.
Can I re-record this?
No, what happened is I thought of that intro last night, and then I didn't think about it for the past 24 hours or so, and I remembered that I was going to do it mid-sentence. So that's what that sounds like. Anyway, we are so happy to be with
live
you.
Live radio, everybody.
It's not live, James. Shut up. Anyway, we are so glad to be here doing another episode of the podcast for everybody, and we're going to have some listener mail coming up in a little bit, but first up is new business, and I thought we would start with Mike.
Hey, everyone. I'm going to talk a little bit about Mario Golf for the 3DS, because I know you guys touched on it when the demo came out. And it is kind of a shitty demo.
Yeah, we shit on that shitty demo.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm enjoying it. It kind of grew on me. I bought it in spite of the demo. I played the demo and thought it was a pretty bad demo as well. But I said, you know what? I feel like playing a Mario Golf game. So I bid on it. And overall, it's pretty good. I think the single player experience for like the quote unquote RPG mode type thing, I think they call it the Castle Club, is pretty weak. There is writing, but it's very generic sounding. I mean, think Camelot at its worst.
Dot dot dot.
Well, yeah, and it just, they have the Mario characters, but they don't really have any personality. It's like they're all kind of the same character, but like, oh wow, you did a really good job. Oh yeah, great job, everyone. Yeah, you know, oh, I'm impressed how well you did on that tournament.
Yeah. Right.
And
it ain't exactly Mario and Luigi.
Exactly, and they have like a sound effect that they play every time someone talks, and it's like the same sound effect. So you just hear like the boo go, like, you know, over and over again, that kind of stuff.
Oh, lovely.
And so. It's, I would say it's more like it's really just a kind of like turns into a tutorial. Like it's your way of cutting your teeth on it and getting good on it. And I think the focus really has been on the online tournaments and stuff. And I haven't fiddled too much with it, but, there's some cool stuff in there. You can customize your character and they have different, you know, you earn coins by, you know, completing rounds and doing well. And so you use those to buy shirts and golf clubs and golf balls, and in some cases those affect your stats, and there are a lot of kind of ones that are just skins.
But so the currency allows, like, gives you an advantage, right?
The yeah, coins? I have so much money.
Just like life.
No, I'd say that like there's like 10 of each type that are basically the same stats, and it seems like there's a pretty good balance between them. Like whenever you get something that's going to make you go farther, it's going to do something to your accuracy or your maybe like the speed at which you swing, so it makes it harder to play.
Okay.
And so there's a good balance there.
Right, but would the people who bought all three download the DLC packs and who got the gold Mario, which seems to gain money just by swinging the golf club, would they gain like some stupid advantage over everyone else? Or
Guillaume's getting right to the dark heart of play to win.
I don't think so. Golf. I mean, maybe they have more things to unlock in the shop, but for the most part, it's fashion, you know, it's more of customizing your character. It's from a looks. I mean, you don't need much money. Where you unlock some better, yeah, where you would unlock better costumes would be, more of like completing challenges where you unlock kind of like the the Bowser costume or the Luigi costume, which kind of dresses your Mii up, and then you have very different stats. But to be honest, in a lot of the tournaments, you can play as either your Mii or any of the other Mario characters that have a bunch of stats. So, yeah, you're going to have an advantage if you play enough to unlock the star versions of the characters, kind of like in like Mario Tennis and other Camelot games.
So the star versions are just strictly better versions of that character.
Right. They're harder to use, but if you've unlocked that character, you're probably good enough to use a lot of the star ones, maybe not all of them.
Yeah.
Because the ones that hit, you know, 290 yards or whatever are going to, you have to hit pretty much exactly correctly every time or you're going to duff it.
I need performance enhancing drug testing in the Mushroom Kingdom, please. 290 yards is 290 yards is a tragedy.
I find that there are a few people that are way outliers, and I have to think they're hacking it or they found some trick, because it's the kind of thing where you'll play a 9-hole match and they'll have minus 14 or minus 18. It's like, how do you even do that?
Yeah, on 9 holes. Yeah. That's pretty crazy.
They have 8 strokes on a 9-hole course. What you're telling me.
It's like, exactly. You know, there was a tournament that it's probably about to close, but that was a Nintendo World Report tournament that I know several of our listeners played in and Greg played in. Greg smoked everyone. I actually played for a while and finally got the same score as him. But
hold on. Are we about to accuse Greg of cheating? Because I'm all aboard for that. I'm all aboard for accusing Greg of cheating. Greg, if you are listening, you are a dirty cheater.
This is across the board. Balco Leahy.
So I'm a cheater too, because I got the same score eventually. I think he got like minus 12 or minus 11.
I mean, I'll accuse anybody of cheating. That's fun.
Yeah. No. But overall, it's a pretty well put together golf game. As long as you don't mind like the 3-button golf. I mean, it's got an interesting variety, especially if you get the download pack, which I haven't really bought any of them, but there's plenty in what you buy. I mean, they made an interesting choice to go with more they have 9-hole courses for all the Mario themed things. And it seems like that allowed them to have a bit more variety because they, instead of making one, you know, 18-hole desert theme thing, they'd have 1 9-hole desert thing, 1 9-hole. And they get pretty out there. There's one that's all underwater and they have like pipes that blow your water if you're not, your ball if you're not careful. And, like there's a.
Where's this going?
Yes. I said single. You know, there's a course where they have like bombs, and if you hit the bomb that's like in, you know, embedded in the fairway, it'll blow up and knock your ball elsewhere.
Oh, cool.
So I think they do a better job than in the prior Mario Golf games of really using the Mario franchise. And I think that's pretty cool. It's pretty creative.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty happy for – it was like, what, $30 for the – you know, without any DLC. And that seems perfectly fair, even if you aren't going to be doing a lot of tournaments. It seems like a pretty fun game just to have available when you just want to play a little round of golf.
Yeah, sure. So what else you been playing, Mike?
Well, I took a risk, and people are going to be shocked, but I purchased for this trip I'm on here Mega Man Extreme 2 for the Game Boy Color Virtual Console. And as listeners may know, I'm not a big Mega Man fan. I enjoyed X, but most of the other Mega Man games tend to piss me off. Even as much as I love Shovel Knight, there are parts in it that piss me off, and I usually trace them back to Mega Man, like, you know, spikes on the ceiling that I jumped into and died or knocked back into a pit or whatever. But I found that when I was playing Shovel Knight that having unlimited continues really kind of lessened my frustration with it. So I thought, you know what, let me give another Mega Man game a try, one where I have save states so that I can, you know, not worry too much about having to play a level over
right. If,
you know, I get to a boss and, you know, he smokes me.
Save states really are kind of like unlimited continues. I mean, yeah, you can choose where you put the continue point, so yeah. Maybe they're a little overpowered in that way, but they're fundamentally not that different. I mean, you still have to get past whatever difficult part it is at least once.
Yeah.
I use them sometimes just when I get through something that's really difficult that I don't necessarily want to do again. Mm-hmm. That's a great place to use a save state.
Yeah. So so I've gotten through, I think, the four first robot bosses at this point. I played some more last night. Overall, I actually am enjoying the game in spite of some places. Like there's See, I played X, and I guess Extreme 2 is some mixture of the first Mega Man X and the sequel.
I think it's the first three, if I recall correctly.
So there are parts that are like kind of familiar to me that maybe are easier for me because I played them. But
so,
anyway,
so it doesn't reuse any levels, but it uses some similar ideas.
Really? Because it seemed like there was like a mini boss that I totally remember this water level.
It reuses bosses, definitely. But the actual structure of the levels are kind of reimaginings.
Okay. Well, overall, I found that the controls were pretty good. I don't know if I like the double tap to dash, but I understand why they did that. There's just limited buttons.
So you can move that to the select button, I think, in the menu.
Oh, that would be useful.
Yeah, so
I didn't turn on the auto charge. I don't know. I find that the bosses are kind of cruel. A lot of them seem to kill you really quickly. Like they just if they hit you, you lose like a third of your life. The localization or translation is horrendous.
Oh, it's bad.
Really bad. It's really bad. It doesn't make any sense. It's just terrible.
I was in middle school when I played this game originally. And knew it was garbage. So yeah, it's garbage.
Yeah, it's really bad. And even worse, I think it's impacted the transparency of some of the game's mechanics. I beat the four first bosses without realizing I can switch between Mega Man X and Zero, which I guess you can do in the menu. I didn't know that until after I beat those. And by the way, you can switch after Mega Man's like almost dead to Zero, so it's almost like an extra health bar.
Oh, wow.
And so that was one reason I was struggling so much with the bosses. I didn't even know I could do that switching. In a similar vein, there's a shop, and I thought I'd purchase things to use, but apparently I had to equip them, and I didn't know that I had to actually equip those items. So again, I went through these four bosses without – so I don't know if I just got lucky at a certain point to beat them because, I do a save state, so I didn't have to play – I don't know. The Volt Catfish pissed the hell out of me. I don't.
But you're blaming the translation on this.
You're gonna blame. I mean, you can blame the translation for Volt Catfish, but not for it being hard.
Well, I was gonna say that the Volt Catfish has like a move that he shoots like lightning diodes at the top and bottom of the screen, and it like follows you. And I couldn't figure out a way to really dodge those things. And so I beat him because he didn't happen to use that move on me. and after like 20 tries.
Wow.
So there's some balancing issues there. Although again, I didn't ever use Zero during that boss. Cause I figured, you know, I chose, and you first start this game, you can choose between the X mission and the Zero mission. I don't know what that does, but
so
I kind of assumed that meant, oh, I can't play Zero. I'm playing as X because I chose X. Apparently not.
I believe you face a different set of the four bosses. So there's eight bosses total eight Mavericks in the game. And I think if you beat one, you get one set. You beat one, you get the other. And then when you beat them both, you get to play the 1 through 8 series. And you get sort of like a true ending to the game. That's how Mega Man. So the first Mega Man X game didn't let you play as Zero, but you beat regular mode and hard mode, and that gave you two different sets of bosses. And then there was X mode or whatever they called it, and that gave you all eight.
Yeah, you mean the first Extreme.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember that about Mega Man X for Super Nintendo.
No. Extreme. No, so all the Mega Man X games are 8 Robot Masters right out of the gate. The Extreme games grid you down to 4 for some reason. I don't quite know why.
Game Boy tradition, maybe?
Might be.
I don't know. I will say Triad Thunder was the name of that move, by the way. Why do I remember that? Because I don't want to remember important things in my life.
Why would you need those, James?
I do want to ask, though, do you remember the name of the really shitty currency in this game if you're talking about the localization?
Oh God, it's like Soul DNA or something.
DNA
really
Soul, yeah!
DNA Soul, I'm very close.
Oh, it's so
yeah,
bad.
Nothing makes sense about the translation. It's completely horrendous. I think in the cutscene that opens up, they have a typo that, God, it was a really, really bad typo. I turned it into a different word.
Oh, yeah.
In the very first cutscene?
So in Mega Man Extreme, they typoed a character's name throughout the entire game, and they just fucking left it when they released it.
Oh, my God.
So the name is just straight wrong. It's beautiful. Oh, it's awesome. So good.
Yeah. Like Iris.
It's canon now, you know?
So, I mean, I loved these two games when they came out on the Game Boy Color. Because for what they were great. And when they came out on the virtual console, I bought both of them. I've played both of them. I still love them. I think there's a certain degree of irony in my love for these games at this point. Like, I sort of respect that this is probably the dumbest way Capcom could have put these games out. But I'm really glad that they made these games and released them and did whatever the hell it is that Capcom does when they release games.
I think it plays pretty well, all things considered. The basic controls feel
functionally good.
Good.
I think I enjoy them to an extent because of all the quirkiness that came out of the port. Yeah. I think part of my joy comes from just ridiculous stuff where Mega Man is really only two colors, blue and white. And occasionally you'll see pieces of the background pass through the white parts of him. And you realize it's just because the sprite art freaked out for a second, but I appreciate that they made the effort.
All right. Well, James, why don't we hear what you've been doing for new business?
Yeah. So I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of what I've been going through on the eShop lately. Because ultimately, I just finished Edgeworth 2. I enjoy it quite a bit. Just kind of hammered through Wind Waker. It's Wind Waker, whatever. But I was trying to find something to talk about on the show. Just last couple days, I've been on kind of the lookout. And I was working through the eShop, and what I found is that I was trying to figure out ways that Nintendo could present this information to me in a way that makes me more likely to buy something. And this is in part came out of the conversation we had last week when we were discussing successor / refresh of the 3DS lineup. And it seems to me, and a lot of the readers kind of responded in the same kind of mental process, that Nintendo was probably going to try to continue to develop what their sales model looks like. And electronic sales obviously are very conducive for them in that front. So I was trying to figure out how to make the eShop work in a way that lets me buy things that I don't necessarily know are in there.
Are you specifically talking about the 3DS eShop?
No, both. But okay. But 3DS, I'll limit it to 3DS just to keep the conversation somewhat focused.
Okay.
So I went in with no idea what I wanted to buy. That was I wanted to take that experience of going in without any concept of what I wanted to get. And I have a ton of money on the eShop, so it didn't really matter what the price point was.
So you were just like, lead me to the water, eShop.
Yeah. I am looking for something to play, Nintendo. This is your chance to extract money from me. And ultimately, they didn't get anything. That's kind of sad. But what I found was that all those organizational points on the eShop, 3DS eShop channel specifically, if we're going to talk about one. It breaks them up into boxes and like they sort them like new releases or they had like the Atlas sale featured on there. They had some other stuff. It was just kind of random groupings. And then there's like the recommended for you segment.
Yep.
Is that specific to an individual?
That's what I'm trying to figure out. So
I've been exactly where you are, James. I often just open up the eShop and say, hey, what's new? What's on my wish list? What's new? I often am like, okay, well, I don't want to buy anything today.
Recommended for you. I'm trying to figure out if that is actually recommended for me. And I'm leaning towards the answer being no, because I saw in there games I already owned digitally.
Yeah, I think it's recommended for everyone.
Which would mean it's probably not recommended for me because I've already owned that game. And in fact, you wouldn't let me buy that game again. And that's kind of a disappointment. So I've bought a lot of games. On this podcast, I probably am relatively underusing my eShop, but I would say on the average consumer of the eShop, I'm probably a fairly high-end consumer. I've bought a decent number of games, 20-ish digitally. And except on the, in
yeah,
this
I think
group,
Nintendo would be thrilled if every person who owned a 3DS bought 20 games on the eShop.
In this grouping, I may come off as a relatively low-end buyer, but in general, I've given them enough information to start making inferences.
Yeah, yeah.
And what I found is that I can't make heads or tails out of any game listed unless there's no personalization involved in the suggestions.
Maybe it's actually taking the data that you give them when you fill up the surveys that are within the eShop, which are different from the Club Nintendo surveys, which blows my mind.
Wait, what? There are eShop? I've never gotten an eShop survey. What are you talking
about? It's not really a survey. It's like you can rate titles.
Yeah, you can do
that. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Which I haven't done since the Nintendo channel, probably, on Wii.
Yeah, I haven't done that for ages.
The only time I rated a title was a review game I got that was one of the most abhorrent things I've ever played. And I wanted to make sure people understood, no, this is way worse than you think it is, no matter how bad you think it is. So if that's the case, then yeah, I could see why they would just be straight up going like, well, I mean, I don't know what to recommend for you. The only thing we know is that you hate games about alligators going down a river. So what I was thinking is, what would be the best way that they could present information based on what I've bought? So Nintendo knows both what I've played digitally and what I've put into the 3DS, because 3DS keeps track of that stuff. And they could certainly serve it back to Nintendo, and I'm fairly confident they do. And they could look at how long I've played it. Because again, I'm fairly confident they do. The terms of service say they can, so I'm sure they do it.
Hey, I'm pretty sure the recommended for you is working on my 3DS because it shows a big picture of Waluigi.
No, that's what everybody got. So I have Waluigi right now as well.
Well, I mean, Waluigi is recommended for everyone.
Yeah.
Apparently not Nintendo, because they still won't give him a game. So my question is, how could they best do this without it coming off as creepy, but still serving their purpose of selling games to me? And I thought about it. I went back to like a white paper I read on Amazon's recommendation algorithm. And they talk about how if they're a little too on the nose, it can freak people out. Target actually had a very similar situation where they sent somebody coupons for baby diapers because they put together the symptoms to determine that person was pregnant before they did.
Yeah.
Wow.
So there's always this kind of like, how do we maintain?
By the way,
I love
how you said symptoms like it's a disease.
Well, they determined like they were buying anti-nausea stuff. They were buying like headache medicine. Like, you're fucking pregnant. You know that? And I straight up sent them coupons for like diapers, and then it came out later. Like, guess what? So, what I would like to see personally is Guillaume's idea of when you rate games, it factors in. I think that's really important. But I think ultimately they could look at how long I play a game and make recommendations. So, if I recall correctly, there is a Shining Force Game Boy. I mean, I was Shining Force Game Gear game out there.
It's heavily weighted to you, by the way, James.
Really, it should be. So every time I open that screen, I've got like 100-something hours logged in Fire Emblem. Every time I open that screen, that game should be in that list.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Every single time. And it's never in that list because it's a Game Gear game, and I wouldn't recommend Game Gear games to anybody because the Game Gear is terrible. But
that's a fact.
That game should be showing up, and instead I'm seeing Sonic Game Gear games show up in there. And that's terrible. I'm trying to figure out what I want out of an eShop, personally. And part of the mental process, I would like to get recommendations based on what I've played a lot. I don't know how you guys would feel about that. And that's kind of why I wanted to have this conversation now. I'm curious, like if Nintendo was straight up looking at your activity log and was recommending you games based on what you've played a lot of, would you be okay with that?
Well, some of my favorite experiences were really short games, so it would have to be in relation to how much other people have played it. Like, I'm not sure if I would want the eShop to think, wow, this guy really loves Tomodachi Life. Let's suggest a Disney vacation
or something. History indicates you do really love Tomodachi Life.
Yeah, but also how he rated the game would also come into play. Like, you can put a lot of hours into something and think it's like a 3 out of 5.
Right.
Yeah, but if you're going to put a lot of hours into it, isn't it likely that you would probably be willing to have a similar experience?
Maybe, but maybe if it was something that other players had similar hour counts on, but maybe it was rated higher, so maybe that would interest you more.
But do you actually rate games is the question.
I don't.
Yeah, there's the problem.
I think the rating system is not going to be a reliable way, but I like the idea of how much you've played relative to other people that have played that game. That's a good indicator, I think, in a lot of cases. And also the quantity, right? So if you've bought 3 platformers and, you know, in the last 6 months, you probably like platformers. You should probably weight a little more heavily on other platformers on the eShop.
So, but then the question
is... And that's
a
pretty easy thing to correlate, right? I mean...
Yeah, but then the question is, would Nintendo be better served showing you more platformers? Or would they be better served showing you something else that they think people who play platformers might be interested in?
Right, and also Nintendo sometimes isn't the best to classify games in the right genre. And also some games
better than
kind
Amazon.
Sure, but also games sometimes fall outside of established genres, and
sure.
You probably wouldn't want people to completely miss out on them just because, well, they're not exactly a platformer.
There are other metrics too, right? The developer, publisher, I'm sure,
sure
they can have a couple of things, and they don't have to shove it in front of you, but you know, if they know that you like platformers, maybe they show a section that just says platformers, and that's one of your headings in the eShop, right, that you can click on. It's like, oh yeah, I like platformers, maybe I'll...
Yeah.
Browse through
oh,
this.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, you know, really offering you that at the expense of maybe some other gameplay styles, but at least it knows that's kind of a trend of type of game you like, so maybe you would like to see a list of those.
Yeah, like, I got really excited when I saw that there was a section for Wario, and then I realized half of it was Mario stuff anyway, so that was
yeah.
disappointing. But, like, stuff like that where, okay, that maybe I've got three WarioWare games that have gone through this 3DS. Well, that's kind of a high number. Let's serve this dude more Wario because he's clearly got something wrong with him. And
yeah, maybe yeah. there's a Wario game that he hasn't heard about and has never played.
This
or doesn't
dude
know
downloaded
that it's available
Wario
on 3DS Virtual Console.
He downloaded WarioWare Snapped. He has problems. Let's see what we can show him that also would indicate he's got issues.
Let's see if we can push him over the edge.
He downloaded Photo Dojo and WarioWare Snapped. He hates himself and others. Like, I feel like there's opportunities here that aren't being used. And while this may come off as exploitative, if you're kind of like getting these really hyper-specific recommendations, I think ultimately it would allow you to better filter through this ocean of content. Right now, if you think back to Iwata's comments a few years ago with respect to just being drowned in software that has no value, driving the total value of even good software down, part of the problem is just sifting through refuse. And I'm not saying that the eShop on either the Wii U or the 3DS is full of refuse. There's some out there, obviously. But it would be nice if there was some mechanism to make my browsing more efficient. If there's stuff that they know I'm never going to be interested in, 3D Pets. I don't need Ubisoft's 11th 3D Pets game on the 3DS. And that's probably about an accurate count. I don't want to see them. I don't care. Make them not part of this. And nothing in my browsing history would indicate that I would want to see those things. If Nintendo could do something...
It'd also be nice if there was just a thing... If there was a thing you could click on that said, I'm not interested in this kind of thing.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and that would work too. Just something that makes my browsing experience more efficient, makes it more likely for me to actually spend money on a game. Because right now, I go into the eShop, I wade through the virtual console, I get stuck in this Game Gear no man's land, where it's just like, how about Tails game? No, nobody wants to play a Tails game. Nobody has ever wanted to play a Tails game. And then I just abort.
Wait, you mean
Tails Adventure?
You mean T-A-I-L-S, not T-A-L-E-S.
Yeah, yeah. A game about Tails, the fox genetic freak show in the Sonic universe.
Yeah, Miles Prower. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, nobody's ever wanted to play a game about him, but there it is. Like,
I played a little bit of it. It is not good.
Of course it's not. It's a game about him, and it's on the Game Gear. Of course it's terrible.
I like playing as Tails in Sonic games. I do not like that game.
You're on a Game Gear. This is the Game Gear experience.
I think the eShop has come a long way, and it will continue to develop, because it's becoming a larger and larger part of their business. It might be, you know, 10% or 20% of the business now, but, you know, in the coming years, that'll probably go way up.
The eShop's gone from kind of a novelty. On the Wii Shop channel, it was garbage. The DSi shop was somehow even worse.
Yeah.
Both the eShops now are usable. You know, I can get in, I can get done what I need to get done if I know what I want. But I really want it to get to the point where the experiences I have when I go to video game stores to find something for this show, and I would just walk in going, all right, let's find something stupid. And then I would just kind of walk the store for a few minutes, and eventually I'd come out with something that going in I didn't think I wanted, but coming out I'm like, all right, well, this could be a disaster, but whatever. I want it to be the point where browsing that stuff isn't a chore. It isn't me paging through page after page after page of NES Virtual Console games. Like, Cuckoo Land and friggin' whatever. Just make this so I can get stuff I want to see. And I think that's going to extract more money out of me than showing me stuff that no one would ever want to play, like frickin' Ice Climbers.
All right. Well, we've crapped on Ice Climbers enough recently. Let's move on to John. John, I heard that you just joined the next generation.
Well,
he already had an Xbox One. We played it.
Yeah, what, John, I heard that you just joined the next generation.
Yeah, I did. I just picked up Super Mario Land 2.
Wow.
So there you go. Yeah, so see, it was the choice was between Ice Climbers and that. So.
Oh, great. Great.
How's that for a segue?
So you said, well, one of these games is garbage.
Yeah, and then, you know, I picked up Super Mario Land 2. So.
Well, good choice.
Yep.
But yeah, it's a pretty weird Mario game. I can
yes,
tell you that.
It is.
Now, bear in mind, I never owned a Game Boy, right? So a lot of this stuff is completely new to me. And yeah, really not what I expected. I expected something closer to kind of a, I expected something different, but not this different. Let me put it that way. I haven't played too much into it, but it's kind of blowing my mind. Like, I really don't know what's going on when I come to the end of a stage and there's a bell there that I have to ring and the exit is just a door.
Yeah, what's the original Mario Land?
I mean, this is Mario Land 2, 6 golden coins, correct?
Yeah, yes, correct. This is Mario Land 2.
This is the moment where Nintendo felt the need to introduce yet another member of the Mario ilk.
Yeah, I haven't gotten to that point. I mean, I've been kind of mind boggled by stuff like the, I think the rabbit, is it the rabbit cap?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
There's the rabbit cap that lets you, like, hop in the air.
Sure.
You say sure, but I'm just like, sure?
are you positive?
Like, yeah. So,
am I awake right now?
Yeah, and, you know, like, kind of like the overworld map is, I mean, I was kind of, the thing is, the overworld map, I didn't expect it to be in something, I guess, this early.
My dates might be a little bit off because in Japan, the Mario 3 came out so much earlier than in North America. But even like Super Mario Land 1, I thought was kind of a contemporary of Mario 3, even here.
Like, yeah. I remember so Mario Land 2 came out in late 92, if I recall correctly.
So it's later than I thought then.
Yeah, this is roughly contemporaneous with closer to 3 in World.
Okay.
Yeah, it definitely borrows the aesthetic of World in some cases.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Yeah, definitely not what I expected.
Yeah,
that's
and
sure.
I remember playing it back then just thinking, well, this rabbit cap is pretty cool, but it's no substitute for the raccoon tail. You know, it doesn't let you fly. It's just, you kind of fall slower.
Yeah,
awesome.
But the space helmet, man. John, you probably haven't even seen that yet.
No, I haven't seen the space helmet yet.
In this game.
Oh,
yeah,
the space
it is. It's
cool. Really
yeah.
Cool.
And I don't know, like I guess turtle zone and I'm inside the whale.
Yes, you are.
You have to dodge a whole bunch of teeth and you can, it has this weird sort of almost like life force motif where it's like you're, everything's all fleshy and you're kind of going through what seems to be the whale's tongue, but you can't fall through it. Like it's a platform. But it's kind of like a mushy platform, so you just kind of fall slowly through it, and you can jump up. It's just really weird.
You're being digested.
I thought it was maybe saliva, but it's kind of floating, hanging in the air.
It's tissue, which is kind of unnerving. You know what I'm saying? Like in a Mario game, I'm like,
so John, tell us about your experience with some fleshy tissue.
I'm hopping through it. That's the best I can say.
Great.
I made it to the first boss, and I have no idea how to beat him. It's the floating octopus kind of thing that shoots out guys at you, and I have no idea. I mean, I suppose if I had the fireball,
you want to jump on his head.
That kills me.
Oh,
outright, actually, it one shots me actually, and I can hop on the head of the little guys that he spits out at me, but I can't do anything to them. Like, there's nothing I can do. Like, there's no normal Mario silver bullet that I can throw at this guy to really Now, I can get there and I can do damage to him, I guess, with fireballs, but the screen is so small that typically I just get hit and lose a fireball anyway. So,
it's going to be some form of jumping. Okay. Maybe you jump on his underlings and eventually he dies.
Yeah. Well, and I'm swimming anyways, right? So.
Oh, you're swimming.
Yeah, obviously.
I don't remember that one either.
In a pool of saliva inside the whale. Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. I mean, it's interesting, but it's so far off the beaten path that you just don't see Mario games do this kind of stuff anymore. That's just this wacky. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could have told me, I mean, you could switch like the Mario sprite with something completely different and call it a non-Mario title.
Well, and it would be a totally different game.
That's what they ended doing, right? Because this was a completely different team from the regular Mario team. And they kind of got crazier and crazier as they went. And eventually they decided, well, you know, screw Mario. We're going to make a Wario game.
Oh.
And then like, well, let's not even make it a platformer anymore. Let's just make it like micro games.
Yeah.
So... Yeah, they really... They're one of the crazier teams at Nintendo.
Yeah.
I always thought that in Mario Land 2 and in Mario, I guess Wario Land, Super Mario Land 3, what we really see of Mario, he's kind of a jerk. In a way. I mean, I don't know, John, if you saw the world where it's basically a giant Mechano Mario.
No, not yet.
Yeah, that world's messed up.
That's one of the last worlds, I think.
You can go Mario in pretty much
Zone.
Any order,
they just straight up call it Mario Zone.
Yeah, it's called Mario Zone. It's like, so Mario has a castle. And he has this other thing over here called Mario Zone. He's like, what's wrong with this guy?
Yeah,
it's a giant it's robot Michael of Jackson. Himself. And then the final boss is the three little pigs.
Oh, that's right.
Nothing would really surprise me in this game.
I mean, to me, the memory for this game is Macro Zone, which is such a fucking meta title because it's a giant house where you're the size of a mouse and the final boss is a mouse. This entire game is completely just screwed up.
Yeah, it really is much more of an acid trip than I ever thought it would be. It's really strange for a Mario game.
It's a pretty big acid trip.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the boss is everything. It's not really Mushroom Kingdom. It's Mushroom, period.
Turtle Zone is one of my favorites, too, because it's called Turtle Zone, but you go in a whale.
Well, yeah, and you go in a whale, and you know, on the map, there's like a crashed sub in the at the bottom of the ocean and stuff, and so I'm... Yeah.
It's called Turtle Zone?
I'm still coming to grips with it, is really what I'm saying.
I thought that a turtle ate you to bring you into that zone.
Oh, that might be it. You might be right.
And the whale is asleep, too. I don't know, man. It's just weird.
And you're waking him up because you're a dick. Yeah.
I feel kind of dirty about, you know, I don't know. I don't really know what's going on.
Well, I mean, you haven't made it to Space Zone with the distraught moon yet. I mean, there's something really sinister about this game. No. I mean, the moon looks like he's real depressed.
Yeah.
Like, this is a weird game.
Yeah. I'll believe you. On that,
it has really nice artwork though. That's when I think about Mario Land 2, the thing that always comes to mind first is just it looks incredible. I think for a Game Boy game, the characters are really big and detailed, and the whole game it has some frame rate and clipping sort of problems. Not a big surprise on Game Boy, but I think the artwork just stands out as to me it looks. Even though it's in black and white, in a lot of ways it looks better than most NES games just because artwork is so lavish.
I want to say this was a Yokoi game, actually. Like, he was the producer on this one.
Oh, interesting.
Which would have made it one of the last games he worked on, if that's the case.
At Nintendo, at least.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. At Nintendo, certainly. Yeah.
I mean, I'm assuming this game isn't very long. I remember we talked about, I think, the original Super Mario Land and... It's really short. Isn't it like 2 hours long or something? Like you can just blow through
it. It is really short. Yeah. If you know what you're doing, if you've played it before.
Yeah. It's a lot longer than the one before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Wario Land is the first, I would say, like truly full-length game in this series. Wario Land is considerably a bigger beast, too.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, it plays a good bit differently as well, but it's also just, there's way more content in Wario Land than there is in this game.
Yeah.
Yep.
I remember back in the day when I was just a Game Boy owner and I was looking enviously at my friends who had NESs and Super Nintendos. I was just, the Mario Land games seemed so simple and such, so dumbed down, you know? And Wario Land was really the first one where not only like it had a lot of levels and a really kind of complex overworld map, but also, sometimes when you do something, like when you complete a level or when you finish a world and you beat the boss, then you can go back to previous levels and they'll have changed. You know, like the tide will have gone or will have come up and all of a sudden the level will be flooded where it wasn't before. Or like there's like this cauldron mountain or something where the lid crashes back down when you kill the boss, and then all of a sudden it's completely new configuration in that level. Mm-hmm. So really, really cool. But they, that's not in this game.
Yeah. I mean, so when I look
sorry, it's really awesome, but not this game. No.
When I look at the original Mario Land, I mean, it straight up, it's like a game that would have been made on like a TI-83+. I mean, even visually, it's an incredibly simplistic looking game.
Yeah.
Mario Land 2, it's almost a shame they put the two games in the same ecosystem because they're so vastly different. And mm-hmm. part of that makes sense because Mario Land is like 89. It's early Game Boy post launch. This is almost in the N64 era, 92, maybe basically 93. I mean, that's real.
Super Nintendo, at least.
There's a huge gap even in the Game Boy library in that time frame.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, these games have nothing in common. I would just divorce them entirely. I mean, that Mario Land is weird Sarasara Land nonsense. This is just straight up acid trips.
Mm-hmm.
So, It's Mario Land 2. I love that game, but
I'm quite a fan of it too. John, was this your gold reward for Club Nintendo?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty damn good choice, I think. If people are still trying to decide,
it gave us Wario.
It's absolutely a must play Mario game, I think. Yeah. It's a strange outlier. It gave us
Wario for better or worse.
It's essential. Yeah. And it has Wario, debut of Wario.
I mean, I sure wasn't going to get, like, Kid Icarus for Wii U, or that just wasn't going to happen.
Fuck
so.
That game, God.
Yeah, it became a pretty easy choice when I actually sat down and thought
about it. I wish Ice Climbers
was
there so I could just not get it. I mean...
Well, Ice Climbers is there, I think, for Wii U. It's there.
Jeez.
Yeah. So I could have... It was a tough choice again, but...
You could have wasted your credit on that.
Like, Ice Climbers, I mean, really... Well, how is that a reward? That's like a punishment. It's like, here's your gold punishment,
John.
Ice
Climbers every 10 minutes for the remainder of the show.
God, more like Ice Climbers.
Yeah. Karen saw me playing the Ice Climber stages in the NES Remix, and she was like, oh, I love that game. And I let her play it, and she was, oh, no, I don't.
No,
she
I hate
smashed
that game.
My Wii U on the floor and said, no, and walked out of the room.
All right, guys. Well, we need to move on, actually, and we're going to hear about what Guillaume has been playing.
Right. Well, I've been playing... I've actually used my trial, my 48-hour trial for Wii Sports Club. And so I've played... I think the two latest sports that they added was boxing, which I tried for, like, once, and it's not really improved. Don't bother with it,
no,
really.
No, it hasn't.
And baseball, which actually has seen significant improvements because they decided to assign the pitching and the fielding to the gamepad, and it works extremely well.
Hmm.
You just kind of aim with a gamepad with the motion controls, and then the four face buttons each do like a curveball, a screwball, a fastball, a drop ball. Is that what they're called? Anyway, another Close type enough. Of ball. And... So you just hold the button, and you've got this meter, kind of like a golf game meter that fills up. And if it fills up too much, then like you held the button for too long. But anyway, you want to get, exactly the right time to get exactly the strongest pitch that you can possibly make. And, it's very, very intuitive. It works really, really well. And it adds a lot of depth where there wasn't really in the first, Wii Sports Baseball.
Yeah, that's totally different pitching mechanic than the original.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the fielding is just basically you can with a gamepad, you're aiming at the ball that's coming at you, and you're trying to align two circles. It's nothing really all that out of this world, but it's still pretty cool, and it's more. It's still more responsibility than you had in the first Wii Sports, where fielding was completely out of your hands.
Right.
So pretty fun.
Can you tell there's a difference in the swinging? Because I actually played a lot of baseball with Wii Sports. My sister liked that game a lot, and we played it a good bit. And we're talking about the two of us probably put 10 to 20 hours into this Monkey Baseball back in Super Monkey Ball 2. So she just really likes baseball, and I was happy to play it with her. But on Wii Sports Baseball, I really liked how it was the first time and the only time for a really long time on the Wii that I felt there was this kind of one-to-one motion. You know, when you held the Wii remote, you could see the character on the screen and it would adjust it at, you know, without swinging, you could just kind of barely move the Wii remote and you would see it move around. And there was some lag and it wasn't as, you know, this was before Motion Plus, but it's still convincing and cool.
It still felt right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I played kind of a ton of Wii Sports Baseball, but as we discussed last week, I'm kind of a sucker for that game, for that sport.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. The swinging doesn't really feel any different to me. There's no way to miss, you know, when you swing. It doesn't take into account the angle at which you swing. You could actually hold your Wii remote vertically and just, you know, give a flick of the wrist and it would swing always at the same height. And the only way you can miss is if you swing at the wrong time or at the wrong kind of throw.
Huh.
So it's kind of disappointing, I guess, in that sense. And that kind of goes with all of the sports that I tried, like boxing, for the little that I tried it, didn't really seem to interpret my movements any better than than Wii Sports did on the Wii. And same thing with bowling, maybe. Like, if there is a difference, it's very, very subtle.
You know, I get the impression that they couldn't decide whether they wanted to make this an enhanced port or just get the games out there. And I feel like they aren't really marketing it that much. And
no,
they will for the retail, though. The retail release, I'm sure they're going to push that.
Yeah, okay. Maybe, but I don't know. Like, there's a lot of signs that they're cutting corners or that they're not putting as much effort into it as they could. I mean, just, you know, like, I love the Miis, but in this game, you know, in the first Wii Sports, they were very basic and they didn't do as much stuff as they do now. Like, they didn't have various facial expressions. Like, one of my favorite things now is that, you know, like, that kind of round eye, surprised look that they can get in Tomodachi Life and other, software. But in this game, they're always have the only expression that they have is like their plain face and like they're blinking. And, no wacky costumes. I mean, at least Wii Sports Resort gave you kind of goofy, flowery shirt when you were bowling. You know, you were on a vacation, but here it's just, you look like Rayman, basically.
Guillaume, you should get the Mario Golf game. If you like all those costumes, you can dress up in all sorts of themes.
I don't know, like, that would add a lot to Wii Sports. I mean, you're seeing the Miis, and that's cool. Like, they represent people you know, but if you can make them look goofy and stupid, that's even better.
Yeah, dress them up in a Mario costume or Waluigi costume or themed after question blocks. Or
I can see why it would be very appealing for them to go back in and kind of gussy up the presentation in this game. But ultimately, it is basically just an HD remake, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it is.
The controls are a little different in some cases, but, you know, for things like bowling, they already remade that once in Resort and added the Motion Plus stuff. So I'm sure exactly the same.
I'm fascinated. The idea of the sales pitch for Guillaume is that he can dress up the characters for the Mario Tennis. It's like, just go buy Anne's Doll Studio at this point. You can dress up everything.
Usually I spend as little time as I can in character creation stuff, but the Miis are just, they're people I know, and they're easy to make and
to shame them with outrageous outfits.
Exactly. But also I managed to play some online games with some people. And the online in this game is problematic, as you can probably guess. You know, if you want to, I don't know, to plan playing online, I went on Twitter and I went on a discussion forum and I asked, okay, well, do you guys want to play a game? And I'm going to be online at around 9. And then I had around 9, not only I had to be on my Wii U, but I had to coordinate and I had to set up a chat room because otherwise there was no way that I could tell these people which game I wanted to play.
But isn't that kind of an issue for all Wii U games? I mean,
well, specifically though, you have to be playing the same sport.
Yeah, exactly. Like I would expect in Wii Sports Club to be able to at least jump from game to game easily to follow a friend, but no. Here it's really you can set up like you can host or you can join a game, but you do that from within one of the sports. If you're hosting a game of golf and your friends are looking for you in a game of bowling, they're not going to find you.
Right. There's no universal just, I want to play with my friends, please.
Exactly.
We call this stove piping.
To me, it would make sense if you could just have somebody hosting and maybe they set up three or four events. And then like you have a tournament, but I understand why. It's because they don't necessarily know which games those people own.
Exactly. They don't like they've been selling these games, piece by piece. So they can't really do that. So it's a terrible setup. And I really wish they hadn't done that. I would much rather have kind of a cheaper price for all five games and, you know, be sure that like it's too late now. Because they've already done this, but
it's
to be sure
late.
That everyone has.
They're doing a retail version that contains all the games together, so.
It is too late because people have already bought individual sports. Like, you wouldn't want to gate the people who bought the online version, the eShop version, and the people who bought the retail version. You want them to play together, so it's too late. But anyway, like not only can you not jump from one game to the other easily with the same group of people, but I played golf and one of the options was like three holes random. And that's a good option because you don't necessarily have the time to play nine holes. So we did that. And then once we finished the three holes, there was the option to play again with the same group. So I was like, yeah, sure. So I picked that and people joined the game again. It was the same three fucking holes. There was no option to, get three new random holes. There was no option to change the course at all. Mm-hmm. It was just, you can play this again, this exact same thing.
Well, you did say you wanted to play again.
None of this surprises me in the least. Nintendo does these half-assed online modes, and then they probably look at the metrics and say, well, people didn't really play it that much, so why should we, put a bunch of effort into it and promote it and try to continue doing this. It's like, cause they make it so difficult to actually play their online games online with other people that you know.
Stop
it's
having
ridiculous.
Expectations. God.
And the tragedy here is that the games are still fun. Like I don't recall playing Wii Sports all that much when I got my Wii. But playing online, it's a lot of fun. I was playing golf and bowling and tennis and just people I know. And it was just awesome, I wanted to keep playing. And I'm actually kind of considering getting one or two of the games. But yeah, the online, I wish it were so much better. The other thing that I've been playing, I talked about it briefly last time, but I've been playing the DSiWare version of Mr. Driller. The subtitle is drill till you drop.
And drill till you drop?
Drill till you drop.
Why does this even exist?
And it's just this awesome version of Mr. Driller, which I think I had skipped back in the day because of an IGN review where a reviewer with a chip on his shoulder and an agenda gave it like 6.5 because it didn't have online leaderboards. But turns out it's the most feature complete. It is the most feature complete Mr. Driller that we've ever had in North America. And one feature that had
There's
been.
There's your digital box art.
One feature that had been in Japanese games, including the GameCube Japan only Mr. Driller, is a mode that's kind of based on the Tower of Druaga. And it's mode where instead.
What?
Yeah, I know. It's this mode where it's almost a roguelike. Your air, instead of depleting very fast and, the game being all about action and trying to go really fast, every time that you drill, that uses up 1% of your air supply. Of your air supply. And
air
so,
supply.
Sorry. Sometimes the Quebecer and Me comes out. So yeah, it uses your air supply. And so you have to be really methodical and really think about it. It makes the game more like a puzzle game and almost like an RPG, because you can also find and use these items that will, you know, turn gems into different colors or destroy all the red blocks or, you know, refill your air supply. Some will have like drill three ways, you know, like the three, the block in front of you and the two next to it. And, so you use these items and, you're trying to make it to the bottom of the well. And it's just this awesome mode that we've never been able to play in any other version of the game. So I highly recommend the DSiWare Mr. Driller.
Over the GBA one?
Yeah, the GBA one is terrible.
I will say that I remember playing the Game Boy Advance version of Mr. Driller when Billy came out for E3 2001. We did download play. This is before the GBA was out in the US.
Okay, this is the Japanese version.
This is the Japanese version.
Dear
I didn't
God.
Know what the hell I was doing.
That was the first Mr. Driller. The one that's out on Wii U Virtual Console right now is Mr. Driller 2 for GBA, which is even worse than that first one.
I'm still
suffering from like Tower of Duraga flashbacks, thanks to Guillaume. So I'm gonna go ahead and give Namco a big ol' thanks, asshole, for that.
No, it's awesome, and it's exactly the kind of thing that you want in kind of an action puzzle platformer, like I don't know what to call it. Like it's complete. Well, I mean, it's exactly like it's so completely different, and yet uses the same mechanics. You know, like it gives you like if you want to do something different within the game, like it's perfect. Anyway, I love it. It's awesome.
I'm buying it right now.
Great,
excellent.
Hey, 3DS closed. We're doing a show.
At $5, you know. All right, well, I'm going to wrap up new business this week. Very quickly, I'll talk about Wario Land 3. I've talked about it many times before on the show. Mainly I want to bring it up because Mike is here. But I have been playing it the past week. It's a game that I had on the 3DS Virtual Console last year, and I mentioned it at least once on the show. Lost my progress from the flood, yada, yada, yada. So I started, had
God,
to start it all
John,
over
so
again.
So boring, your struggles.
I know. but I love this game so much, and I didn't get as far as I wanted to the last time I tried it, and I really wanted to play all the way through it again, for the first time since like 2000 or whenever it came out the first time. So anyway, I'm playing back through it again, mostly playing through stuff that I, you know, played about a year ago, probably when it came out on Virtual Console. So I don't have to talk about specific stages or anything, but hot damn, this is such a fantastic portable game.
Damn.
And if you've never played Wario Land 3, I don't know that there's a whole lot of better ways you can spend $5 on the 3DS eShop. It's so, so good. It is such a weird, unusual game. It's so thoughtful and incredibly polished and well made. And it's huge. It's really, there's a ton of content in it. And it's a real challenge, you know? So, I really highly recommend it. You know, I have a couple complaints that maybe I've never voiced before. I mean, some of it is just that sometimes when you play the game by, you go in these stages and they have multiple exits. So every stage has four treasure chests and four keys that are color coded and they go with those treasure chests. This is back when, you know, because this was the first Wario Land that was exclusive to Game Boy Color, they had to use color as a way to differentiate things. So these keys and chests look exactly, you'd be unplayable in black and white, but you can't play it in black and white. It's only color. And it'll do this thing where like you'll go in and it'll indicate that, hey, you should go back to the stage. Something has changed, or you now have a power up that allows you to go to a place you couldn't get to before. And I like that they do that, but you go back in the level and you go to the new area and there'll be a door and you'll go in the door and you'll play through this really hard section of a whole bunch of stuff you have to avoid, and you finally get through it and it's the chest, but it's locked and you don't have the key yet. But this is the first door that you came to. So you're supposed to, I don't know, intuit that maybe you should go past the first door that you find and go to the second one, because maybe it's crazy. It's like, who designed this? All you had to do was switch the doors. You know, like it's so easy to fix this. And I don't understand why they would make you go through the obvious choice and then come to the thing that they know you don't have the key for yet. It's really aggravating. And it's something that this game does a lot. You know, I've talked before about how in Wario Land 3, because you can't die, they find other ways to punish you. And when you mess up or you get hit by an enemy or you fall down, the way that they punish you typically is they make you play through a section over again. Mm-hmm. And sometimes ad nauseum. And it's where having it on 3DS Virtual Console and having save states is so nice because, you know, if you get to a boss battle, the boss battles in this game are kind of notorious, I think, because the bosses can't kill you permanently. All they can do is basically knock you off. They'll send you someplace where you have to go way around to get back and try again. And it's just kind of a waste of time. It's their punishment for not beating it on the first try. They make you go way out of your way and go and try again and maybe try over and over and over. Some of the bosses are really tough. So save states make this way better because you can get to the entrance to the boss. And if you mess up, you just load it and start over, which is effectively what the game is making you do anyway. You're just shortening the time that it takes to get back to that point where you can try again.
Yeah, so I basically did that in Wario Land 2 when I played it.
Sure. So it's a situation in which I have no guilt. I mean, I don't have any guilt about save states anyway, but I think this is one of the most excusable uses of save states you could ever find in that you really aren't doing anything that the game would have made you do anyway. You're not even saving on lives or continues or something because there aren't any. So it's a great way to play the game. It makes the game a little smoother and a little bit less frustrating than it was originally, and it does nothing to diminish all the great qualities of Wario Land 3. So if you skipped over that one last summer, go back to it. I think you'll find it's a very rich experience. And finally, I'll close out with just a few comments on Rogue Legacy because I've talked about this game before as well. So it was a real exciting week around here for me. But I did play more Rogue Legacy because it came out on the PlayStation family of video game systems this week.
Oh, that's a mouthful of marbles.
Yeah, it just came out on PS4, PS3, and Vita all at the same time. And it's cross-buy, so you buy one... You buy any copy, you get all three, which is great for me because I do have all three of those systems, even though I'm never going to play it on PS3. Mm. I mean, why would I? The PS4 version's better. I could stream it to Twitch if I want to, whatever. And then the Vita is really the system I wanted to play it on the most, though, because this game is so well-suited for portable play. It looks a little bit cramped on the Vita screen, and the text is a little bit hard to read, I have to say. But it's not a text-heavy game. I mean, the only time you really have to look at a lot of text is in the menus when you're starting a new character. And, you're not in a rush for that part. Once you actually start playing the game and you're in the action, you don't really need to read that much. So not a big deal, but I was kind of surprised that they hadn't optimized it a little bit better maybe for the format. But, it struck me this week as I was playing more Rogue Legacy, this is really kind of like the Zelda 2 revisit that I'm always asking for from Nintendo. I mean, it has a very similar feel, I think, where you're not using a shield, but you are jumping around and attacking and using magic against these enemies. It's pretty hard, and it's pretty fast-paced, and it does have these RPG sort of features to it that Zelda 2 did. And I think it's a pretty good substitute. I mean, I don't know if we'll ever get another Zelda 2, but for me, it works and it fits in there really nicely.
I didn't get the Zelda. I only played it for about a minute, to be fair.
Yeah, maybe less than a minute.
Maybe less than a minute, Johnny. But I didn't like the controls at all. I don't know if that varies based on the character, but...
It does a little bit. Okay. Yeah,
it
does.
It felt very floaty, the character that I played as, and... I don't know. To me, a lot of the Zelda 2 is the progression and meandering through a dungeon. And I know you're going to get that in this game. It's randomly generated, if I understand correctly. So I don't know how well it does generating those randomly, but I tend to not like randomly generated things.
It's probably the best I've ever seen for randomly generating levels because it just uses pieces, and the pieces are all designed to play very well. And it's just putting the pieces together in different arrangements. And also, it's not completely random because the pieces of level that they give you are informed by your character's abilities, which may be different every time you go through. And that there's a lot of secrets even within those randomly chosen pieces. A lot of them have little tunnels where you might find a treasure chest behind a wall or something like that. So there's a lot of variety there. And also the castle, the castle that you're playing through in the game is set up in a very specific way where there's different sections that represent sort of different levels of the game. So, and they're all hard, you know, like you get into a different one, they're all different levels of difficulty, and you're kind of, you're kind of intended to play them in a certain sequence, although you can play them in any order that you want. But like, for instance, the Maya, which is the sort of, one of them's like a jungle. I don't remember which one it's named, but it's always way off to the right. So like when you start the game, if you keep heading right several screens, you'll end up over there. Mm-hmm. And if that's the part of the game that you want to focus on for a while, because the enemies are harder there and they give more money, or because it's going to have more treasure chests that you care about, then you know generally which way to go to get to that stuff. So it's not completely random, which is exactly why it works. Mm. I think Rogue Legacy is a spectacular game. I've played a good bit of it. One other note about it, it has cross save. So I can actually very easily play it on the Vita for a while and then upload. You just hit a button, you go to the main menu and you hit a button and it uploads your save file to the cloud. And then I go turn on my PS4 and I tell it, hey, download the cross save. And it does that. And now I have all my progress on this other system. It's maybe not quite as seamless as I would like, but it's very easy and fast and it works. I mean, I did it last night. It works perfectly fine. So you can totally take your progress back and forth between the handheld and the console. And not very many games do that. You know, that they're, I think, increasingly common on PlayStation, but like certainly on Nintendo, there's Monster Hunter, I guess, Ultimate, Monster Hunter 3 Ultimate. Other than that, almost nothing supports that kind of a feature. So it's like, in a lot of ways, Rogue Legacy is like exactly the kind of game I'd like to be playing on Wii U or 3DS. I mean, it's very Shovel Knight in some ways. And you know, I think Shovel Knight, one reason I liked it so much is it reminded me of Rogue Legacy, and Rogue Legacy reminded me of some of the games that inspired Shovel Knight. So, you know, if you're done with Shovel Knight and you wish you had more of it, I think you should check this out. But in a lot of ways, it kind of represents everything Nintendo isn't doing right now, because it does have cross buy across these platforms, and it is an independent game that's really being pushed hard by the platform holder, and it has the cross save feature, which is, you know, kind of icing on the cake. So anyway, I still love it. So I still recommend it a lot, especially for Nintendo fans. I think especially we'll find a lot to like in it.
Maybe Curve Studios is going to port this in the future to Wii U or something.
Maybe so. They are porting everything else in the world. Yeah. Well, anyway, that is going to wrap up new business. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
All right, and this week we have a review of Supercar Toys for Wii U by Don Koopman. If there's one thing we need for Nintendo's platforms, it's a kart game.
Yeah.
Especially on Wii U. Yeah. I mean, there's a complete lack of good kart games on Wii U, especially those with mascots.
Oh, whoa. John, we're going to get death threats.
Can Supercar Toys fill this gap? At this point, we'll take anything to spell this drought.
Oh, we're going to die, John. What have you done?
We also have a preview of Fantasy Life on 3DS by Neil Ronahan. Neil gives us his take on the new 3DS action RPG from Nintendo themselves. Learn about its job classes and get his first impressions of the cool-looking enemies you fight in this colorful world.
I think it's actually from Level 5, but...
it's being published
Nintendo's
by Nintendo.
Yes, and please don't kill us.
Yeah. Alright, and we have a review of Master Reboot for Wii U by Sander Nurjic. Sander looks at this first-person puzzle game and lets us know if it's worth our while, while it evokes a nostalgia of 90s PC games. Is that good or bad? Check out this review to find out.
Is it, John?
I don't know.
Speaking of bad, we have a preview of Devil's Third on Wii U by Aaron Brown.
Tomonobu Itagaki is making a violent third-person action game exclusively for Wii U. Sound interesting? Check out Aaron's preview for this cool-looking title and learn why you should start caring about it.
And we have... And we have a feature, Choose Your Own Financials News by Neil Ronahan. Would you like to play a game? That's a board games reference, right? Matthew Broderick. Forget it, whatever. Neil would.
Wow.
He likes to take a look at the Nintendo sales figures and let you decide how you want to overreact to it. Choose your path and go. Hit the comment threads.
I encourage sending emails to RFN Nintendo World Report where I can excoriate your lack of business knowledge.
Yes.
That's what you should do. Last of this week, we have a review of Wooden Sen Say on Wii U by Aaron Brown. If there's one thing we need for Nintendo... Wait, this is the same letter. If there's one thing we need for Nintendo platforms, it's a 2D platformer. Oh, wait, we've already done that. But if you really want a difficult 2D platformer, Aaron can tell you all about the strangely titled game about a man getting his alcohol back. That's a noble enough cause for us. I agree. Let's get drunk. Let's get drunk right now.
Done. Let's go.
All right, that's it. That's all we're going to have for this week. Remember, you can check for news, previews, impressions, and other shit on NintendoWorldReport.com. Drink!
Let's get hammered!
Welcome back to the show, everyone. It's time for listener mail, and the address, as always, is rfn@NintendoWorldReport.com. TYP here is going to read the first email this week.
Ben C. from Detroit, Michigan writes, "Hey, RFN crew. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the Mario timeline. Obviously, Mario 1, 2, 3, and World occur chronologically, with Yoshi's Island as a prequel of sorts. Once you start getting past the main series, however, things start to get a little weird. I have some suspicions that Mario Land series is on alternate parallel timeline to the mainline games. Or perhaps each game features a new Mario, each a descendant or spiritual reincarnation of the Marios of yore. What are your thoughts? I personally hope we get a Mushroom Kingdom Historia from Nintendo to clear up this mess. Thanks. You guys are hunks."
Hold the F up. Because I know for a fact that the Mario Party games are a representation of purgatory, where after everybody has already died. So, I mean, that's the only way to explain what the fuck's happening in the Mario Party franchise.
They're also canon. Yeah,
everyone has died, they are in purgatory for their sins, and now they have to ride around in the stupid cart collecting mini stars for the next 100 years. Settled. So, those have to be at the end, because nothing can come before them. Therefore, Mario Karts happen earlier, progressively they have an accident, and that's how those end. Then every other Mario game is non-canon. Done. Settled. The only Mario canon is Mario Kart. We're out.
I think World has to come before the first three because it has dinosaurs. It takes place on Dinosaur Island.
No, because there's an airship that fell down.
Well that means Jurassic Park takes place before Genesis, Johnny. I mean, Jurassic Park, maybe the good doctor has made dinosaurs. Crossover.
Mario went to Dinosaur Island. That is like what the whole Mario World area is themed after. It's
Mario,
you're in Dinosaur
Super
Island,
Mario
Dinosaur
World is the unofficial sequel to Jurassic Park.
I think it's kind of pointless to try to put like Mario games on the timeline because I think everyone knows that the Mario universe is a multiverse where Mario just like the timeline keeps splitting off every time he dies in a pit.
Fucking
otherwise,
DC
like
Comics.
those pits would be just filled with his own corpses every time. You know, he tried to jump over them.
DC
he'd see his
Comics.
Own...
Comics.
I don't know what that means.
What if there's a council of Marios down at the bottom of the pit?
Yeah, somewhere Carl is just shaking his head.
What if none of the Mario games actually exist and they're all part of a giant illusion that we're all having in our heads?
Well, we know for a fact that Mario 2 is an illusion.
The only real Mario game is Wario Master of Disguise. Fact. Done.
You can go sit in the corner for the rest of this podcast, James.
Next question!
I like to think that Dr. Mario takes place last in the timeline because it occurs after Mario is retired from adventuring and has gone back to school and become a medical doctor.
I would say it's more likely that it takes place first because he's handing out drugs in such a way he's going to lose his license.
So he started off in New York as a plumber.
I think he started off
as a construction worker.
Just writing prescriptions that he shouldn't be writing
loses his license, goes into construction, goes into plumbing, gets into a weird drug habit where he has to race to keep his heart rate up, kind of like the movie Crank, and then ultimately he spends purgatory playing Mario Party.
Oh, he was a painter in there as well. So
a friend of mine pushed the theory, which I'm sure is floating on the internet, that at least some of the Mario games are just shows. Because on Mario 2, there's kind of a stage where you're selecting.
Yeah,
and on Mario 3 also has a similar...
Yeah, the curtains and the fade-outs and everything.
So that might be true, in which case those things are non-canon. It's just a show.
Yeah, Mario 3 is non-canon.
So Bowser is the greatest actor of our time, is what you're telling us. Great.
He's the Orson Welles of the Mushroom Kingdom.
Mario's just a racing celebrity, you know? He puts on these other shows. He's really as famous as a famous car driver. Cart driver.
We can infer that the Mario Karts are all really close to the platformers that are in the same platform. Like, they're not all bunched up together, like, after Mario has retired and started a career in kart racing.
Bowser's effing dead at the end of every platformer. I'd be real hard for him to drive around a kart.
The places that they race in are very close, like are always the settings of the platformers. So you know that, you know, in Super Mario Kart, they're racing around the Dinosaur Island. And in the latest one, Mario Kart 8, you know, like they've colonized space after, you know, the events of Super Mario Galaxy and Galaxy 2. And they've not only colonized space, but they've also built giant ass space tracks. For racing.
I think the fact that Mario destroys the universe and then rebirths it at the end of Galaxy kind of throws all of this really upside down.
Whoa. I don't remember that.
I'm not here to get excommunicated. Thank you. Let's just roll it through.
I don't know if this segment is turning out as well as we had hoped.
I think this segment is turning out to be a disaster, which is all we really can hope for to start with.
It's terrible.
I think we got exactly what we deserved. By the way, when we read questions like this, we just encourage more questions like this, so...
Well, James, what we deserve is another email read by you.
Yes,
do
please.
We? Cliff writes, "It is my belief that it is fruitless for Nintendo to attempt to lure third parties to their home consoles. They have had four straight generations of declining third-party support on their home systems. Nintendo has had a history of designing their controllers for their games. The N64 controller was built to play Ocarina of Time, and it was perfect. I like Nintendo's controllers generally, because it has always felt like a custom-built experience. I'd like to see Nintendo's next controller go further away from catering to third parties and be built around a game concept. Because third parties are afraid of competing with the quality of first-party content Nintendo offers, third parties will never believe a Nintendo console is a viable platform for them. As long as the Xbox and PlayStation brands exist, third parties will choose them as their platform. I love my Wii U, and off-TV play is great, but the controller is based upon menus, maps, and subscreens. And that's not fun. And tell Nintendo, I want some color in my buttons again. My question is, what would you guys like to see in Nintendo's next controller? What features would you add? Are you satisfied with the traditional setup, or would you like a controller with some flair and interesting and creative designs?"
I think the premise maybe is a little flawed here. I don't think that Nintendo is holding back on innovation in their controllers and innovating with their game designs because of third parties.
I don't know. So, I mean, there's stuff like the classic controller, which they more or less rolled out to be like, look, you can play normal games on this system as well.
Sure.
I think certainly part of their design is concern for not being so radical that people don't look at it and go, how the hell do you play video games on that? And that's more or less the same concern that you would have for third parties. I mean, what could Nintendo do on a controller that would be... that would A, make games better, and B, be sufficiently goofy besides making your buttons different colors, you freaking Europeans.
I would love if they colorized the buttons, actually, to go back to that, especially if they went with something like the Super Famicom scheme, which looked so cool, and we never got it here in the West.
That's not true. We got it. They had it in Europe.
Okay, well, we never got it in North America.
Well, there was some color coding in the GameCube.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Two grays, a green and a red.
Yeah, not as great as on the Super Famicom, but I think it's a bit of a fallacy to say that Nintendo designs controllers around specific games. I know that people say that, and that even Nintendo has probably said that at some point.
They have definitely said that in the past, yes.
It's just for the N64 they did, but...
No, they didn't. I mean, N64 is a D-pad on it that Mario 64 does not use whatsoever.
The N64 controller was designed to be a bridge between 2D and 3D games. If you hold your hands in the far position, it's a 2D controller. If you hold them in the near position, it's a 3D controller. That's it. Right. That's all it is. It is. They didn't know what 3D gaming was going to be, so they made a controller that could do both natively.
Yeah, which is very smart.
In retrospect, it looks like a crazy piece of goofy nonsense. But at the time, when you think where the industry was at and where their heads were at, it makes perfect sense.
Yep.
It was probably still good. They probably should have been more confident in 3D games. They probably should have been. They probably should have said, look, 3D gaming is the future. We're going to make a controller that caters to that. But I understand why they did what they did. Now, having the ports for, like, save cards and the controller, that's fucking nonsense. But besides that, you know, it is what it is.
I thought it was really cool. I mean, you have to remember N64 was the first system that Nintendo, well, really that anybody made that had four controller ports right on the front built in.
Right.
So the idea was you're going to play a lot of local multiplayer, which a lot of us did. And they thought in the beginning that people would want to have their own save data that's personal to them, that it's easy, that's on a very small card that you can take around, and or maybe you could put it in your controller and take your controller around. Like, I think there's a lot to be said for that. It didn't never really became that useful. I don't think it was implemented in very much, but that little memory port on the controller also allowed them to do crazy stuff like the transfer pack and the rumble pack. So thrilled that
you still could have done that. You still could have done everything except for the rumble pack without it being in the controller.
Sure, but I think maybe it was a cost-cutting measure. You know, like you wouldn't want four memory card ports that most people wouldn't use on the machine itself if it drove up the price of the Nintendo 64. Even on the GameCube, it only has two. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was really controversial when GameCube was first shown. It's like people were like, what if all four of my friends want to use memory cards, you know? Yeah. Cuz you could do that on N64.
But to that end, most GameCube games looked at the first first memory card port and ignored the second one, so.
Very true. So yeah, I mean, as far as what do I want Nintendo to do with their next controller? Man, I don't know
about the basics.
I don't know that they're going to do with the next controller. Like, what if they just go to handhelds in the future? You know, I mean,
that still effectively becomes your controller. I mean,
yeah, but the handheld controls are so much designed around the form factor of the system itself. You know, I mean, one of the things that I don't like about handhelds, and one of the reasons that I don't play handhelds more than I do consoles, I prefer to sit down with a console and play a game that way, is because I like having a controller that's actually ergonomic. I can't play the 3DS for really long periods of time because it's too thin and it doesn't fill up the palms of my hands and my fingers are wrapped around in a weird way. And yeah, and it weighs too much. So if I could tether a Wii U Pro controller to my 3DS and play 3DS games with that, I might actually do that sometimes. Maybe. I don't know. But, you know, they could do a lot better for the handheld controls. But as far as controllers go, you know, I think, to me, the gamepad is a really smart idea. I don't think they've done a whole lot with it. And I think the gamepad itself is too big and it's a little clunky. But I like the idea of it. In principle, I think the idea of putting a screen on your controller has so many great possibilities. And you know, I think it's kind of a rough draft of that idea. But I still would like to see a GamePad Pro. I'd still like to see them refine that and kind of take that to the next level. Having a microphone built in the controller has worked out great for them. Like, if you ever play an online game with voice chat on Wii U, it's fantastic having that microphone built into it. It's always right up close to your mouth, and everybody has it. You don't have to buy anything extra.
I think that the Wii U Pro controller has a different kind of intention behind it than the Wii Classic controller on the Wii. Like, the Classic controller was like, yeah, you can play regular games with it. The Wii U Pro controller is because you cannot have more than one gamepad at the same time on a Wii U.
That we know.
And, you know, for some games, well, yeah. And for some games, like, you probably would want, like, because the whole, yeah, you can play regular games with this thing, we already know, like, the gamepad already has all the inputs necessary to play regular games. That's never been in question. So yeah, I think that the Wii U Pro is just a temporary measure until they can figure out a way to have, you know, two or more gamepads, at the same time on the Wii U.
Pads aplenty.
I don't know, guys. As much as I like the gamepad, I feel like they rather either reduce the price of the console or put that money towards something more powerful. Sorry.
Here it comes.
It's kind of a different issue. You know, let's talk about the gamepad as a controller, not as the centerpiece of the system architecture, but as a controller, I think it feels amazing for how big it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It feels good. It has good features. But they didn't design around any game. And if that's what this email is implying, that really isn't the case. They thought here's a bunch of useful features that you would get on the controller.
And Cliff's point is they didn't design it around a game. They designed it around menus and maps, and that's why it doesn't feel – it always feels like it's kind of an orphan when it's compared to Nintendo games. And I kind of agree. I mean, to this date, we're almost on the 2-year anniversary of the Wii U's release. And we have yet to see a game that comes out and you're like, this could only have been done on Wii U. And maybe that comes. Maybe that game never happens. And that would be a real shame, and I think ultimately it would show a lack of foresight by Nintendo when they developed the system. I think what the difference between saying this controller is made for specific games, I don't think Nintendo works that transparently. I think they have controller ideas, and then they try to map game ideas to them. And if they think they work, that starts to become, alright, well, let's see if we can iterate on this controller some more. And, I think they probably build prototypes and try different gameplay ideas. If they just don't work, they just throw it in the fire and call it a day.
Yeah. They'll start with an idea, like motion control. What if you could just control it by waving whatever?
Like, what if you could control your movement in 3D space?
Exactly.
some kind of new interface besides a control stick.
Yes.
And, you know, they play around with it that kind of way. But they then will probably build prototypes, test them out, and ultimately, if they like what they see, maybe they take that controller to another iteration and continue to try to make refinements and develop new ideas. I think that's important. And I can kind of see where Cliff's coming from. It doesn't feel like that happened with the gamepad, because ultimately, if you're doing that, if you're iterating the hardware and then iterating the software that you're using to test the hardware against, at the end of the process, you should at the very least have a couple compelling examples of controller hardware synergy. And when the Wii U launched, it didn't feel like those existed. There's some ideas in Nintendo land that kind of get near the mark, but none of them that I feel like if they had brought them to Iwata's desk and said, here, play this, he would have gone, yeah, let's make a really expensive controller.
You know what the killer app was for Nintendo in terms of the gamepad design and making it part of the system? I think it was Miiverse. I think that's what they thought. Here's the thing that we really want to be the centerpiece of the new platform that you cannot do on our competitors. You can only do this with the gamepad. It only makes sense if everybody has this touchscreen in their hand that is really easy to use.
Sure. But I don't think that – but again, that would still be a matter of designing or not around games but around menus and stuff.
Yeah, well, if you consider Miiverse to be a menu, which is, I think, a really unfair characterization. No, but
it's not a game.
No, you're right. It's a communication platform, but, you know, it's fun, at least. It's entertaining.
I find the entertainment of the Miiverse to be somewhat limited, and I think ultimately they blew it up when they introduced stamps anyway, so what's the point?
I think they just should have put color, maybe.
I think they should make the Miiverse sketching as prone to making you a bad artist as possible. Because the real joy in Miiverse is when somebody doesn't realize how bad an artist they are. Yeah. That's where Miiverse's perverse pleasure kicks in.
And when people subvert it to make actually really good art despite the, you know, pretty limited tools.
Yeah, like it's when people draw decent art with the Miiverse, that's the worst. Those people should be banned immediately. only the people who truly don't recognize how abhorrent an artist they are, or the people who have completely hacked the thing to make amazing art should be allowed to use the Miiverse. If you're not the worst artist ever or the best, get out.
That's why I don't post on Miiverse more, because I know I'm a bad artist.
Because you're too good.
I'm so good, I know I'm a bad artist.
Yeah, one thing that struck me playing Game & Wario is that they do have a ton of ideas for how to use the gamepad. It's just that they never seem to be able to flesh it out into a full game. It's still neat to see this kind of inventiveness. And I just realized, you know, playing with the doodads that you unlock in Game & Wario, just how the third parties and Nintendo themselves, to a degree, have not really been trying that hard. You know, like, we haven't seen kind of new ideas, like, even just, not even in terms of gameplay, but in terms of presentation. I mean, Game & Wario shows you kind of like the cartridge of the minigame that you're going to play, and then the cartridge flies off from the gamepad to the TV, and then you start playing the game. It's a very little thing. It kind of gets annoying, like, when you keep seeing it over and over again, but it's still kind of a cool presentation
feature. But I want more of it.
And even, well, I don't know, like, it's cool the first time that you see it, so, I mean, the problem here is that there are mini-games that you're meant to replay over and over again, so you keep seeing the same thing over and over again. It gets old. But I could see, like, a full game implementing that kind of stuff in interesting ways and not feel like, you know, it's just repeating itself.
Well, here's the real tragedy of the gamepad is that some of the kinds of games that are the easiest to imagine taking advantage of it and doing really, if not super cool things, at least really useful and practical things, I would include, like, simulation sports games, which are not really found on the platform,
yep.
And RPGs, which are not really found on the platform.
They're not really found on any console right now.
Yeah.
Maybe, but they're not on the Wii U, which is, to me, the gamepad is so perfect for RPGs. And maybe we'll find out with Xenoblade, you know, what they can really do with it. We haven't seen that yet, but
that's one game, right?
You know, I can think of a thousand things that would be super useful. Well, it's one game, and there's Dragon Quest X. I don't know exactly.
That's two
what
games.
It does with the
it's gamepad. Like it's like I don't know. This is like the story of Nintendo platforms, where it's like this one game will solve all the problems. You know, I don't know.
We already see what Japanese developers can do with RPGs on the on the gamepad just by looking at the 3DS, by looking at the DS, by looking at the Vita.
I don't agree though, because none of those are home console games where you're encouraged to sit down and spend a ton of time with them. I think
but you still do.
The structure. You still do, but I don't think they're built from the ground up that way. I think a truly, you know, hard designed console RPG that has touchscreen control, but two screens is going to be a different experience than something designed for the 3DS.
I feel like something like Skyrim would be like, you know, like having that touchscreen with inventories and things like that, it could dramatically change the flow of that game and the way that you play it. And I don't know if we're ever going to see that kind of game on the system just because of other issues that probably had very little to do with the gamepad. And it's too bad, because I think it'd be cool to see that kind of stuff implemented. But, you know, another, if we could get away from the gamepad maybe a little bit, but I think the next big frontier for controller design and controller features is coming up pretty soon, and it's probably going to happen before Nintendo takes another crack at it. It's going to be maybe a little bit from the Steam controller, you know, the thing that Valve's making. I don't know how innovative that's going to be in the end, because they've rolled back on some of the weird features that they had originally planned.
Yeah, because they were bad ideas.
Yeah, because they sucked.
There was some stuff that was concerning.
No, that double touch control pad thing was a shitty idea.
And the buttons around the, you know, the right kind of stick.
Yeah.
There's no stick.
It's
you know
bad.
What I mean? It was just stupid.
It looks like something Atari would have designed for a late Atari console.
Jaguar 2.
Okay, but it still has programmable touchscreen buttons in the middle, which I think could be really neat and makes a lot of sense for the, you know, when you consider the huge scope of games that they're trying to support with that thing. But even more so than the Steam controller, I think Oculus has to be working on a controller for their thing. And when you get into VR, you're dealing with game design issues and ergonomic issues that have never really been addressed very much before. And I think it'll be really interesting to see what direction they take with the controller for that thing. And that may, in fact, be a preview of some stuff Nintendo's doing. If I don't think Nintendo's going into VR hardcore, I think Nintendo has been experimenting for a long time with changing the way we look at our spatial relationship with video games. With Wii, they did it. And with DS, they did it, and more so even with Wii U, because they're now separating screens and they're putting different parts of the game in different parts of your room and different parts of the audio in different parts of the room. And I think, you know, Oculus deals with some of those similar kinds of things. And I think, you know, Nintendo seems to be very interested in removing parts of the game from the TV and putting them in different parts of the room. And Miyamoto's talked for years about how, like, his least favorite thing about video games is that he's stuck with TVs. He's like, I'm not a TV designer. I don't have any control over what TVs people have in their homes. And I don't really like that the TV is this huge component in the game experience that I don't have any control over, and that I don't know what people are going to be doing with it. And I think, you know, gamepad is an extension of the idea of kind of taking things off of the TV, but maybe and I think Oculus is as well. Maybe Nintendo has yet another idea, and then the controller will support that in some way.
I think one of the interesting challenges for the Oculus is that because there is no, you can't look down to see what button is. I mean, I have that problem when I'm playing on a PS3 or any other system. I don't know the button layouts. I don't remember which one's square or circle.
Maybe they go back to the GameCube idea, which is that the buttons are different shapes, and so you can feel them without looking at them. You can feel which ones are different.
Right.
Maybe something like that.
But see, I think in general, gameplay layout, you should be able to kind of intuit which buttons are which to a certain extent. Like, if the game and the controller are both designed well, you probably don't need to look down, even if you don't necessarily know that A on the 360 controller is the one at the bottom. Because it's sort of a natural, like, I've gotten used to normatives that say that this is my agree, this is my disagree button. It's not necessarily
that,
about what
that isn't on consistent across platforms. It really isn't.
So that position being the agree button is generally consistent, with the exception of some, you know, early PlayStation Japanese games where they, like, flipped it and said, no, X is yes for some reason. But I mean, in general, I don't necessarily know that there needs to be some great internalization of what the future of the interactive experience is for the next controller. I think ultimately they need to make a controller that is useful in as many situations as possible. I think ultimately the gamepad, while it's a very interesting piece of hardware and does a lot of things, there are some obvious cut corners where certain types of gameplay just suffer. Mm-hmm. And it's important to try to make something that, while it gets across the idea of what you think is important in gaming at that moment in time, that it is adaptable enough that you could do whatever it is you need to do with it.
Well, I'm curious what kinds of gameplay you think suffer with the game.
Oh, we've talked about it a little bit. So, like, when I was playing, Need for Speed, like, you don't have any digital control whatsoever of things like your accelerator.
You mean you don't have analog control?
Analog control. You only have digital control.
I think there is an option to remap that to the sticks, though.
You can, but it still feels kind of weird, and you lose some of the camera and driving. It would be real easy just to have, for example, just.
You don't need stick camera control in a racing game.
I like it, though. I like to look behind me. I just do. Even then, it just doesn't feel quite perfect. You know, there's just something
I think that's in your head.
It's not, Guillaume. It's a fact. It is a fact. Because you don't have analog control over braking either. And you can analog control brake in your car.
I definitely think that that the gamepad should have analog triggers. I think that's it's unfortunate. I don't know if it's an oversight or an intentional choice, but especially considering it has these digital shoulder buttons, which are kind of hard to reach, you know, and feel that good.
That's another thing. Like, there's while overall it feels okay, there's side grip. It could probably use to have more of that. The thing's already big enough, so why not just go ahead and do it? I think ultimately while it's a functional piece of hardware, it's not You know, there are some things about it where they chose to emphasize the screen. And that probably made some other decisions downstream less, I don't want to say good, made them less worried about them.
Mm-hmm.
And that on their next controller, they're going to have the same thing. They're going to have something they want to emphasize. And it's important that while they emphasize those things, that they also get the other stuff right in such a way that it doesn't harm gameplay that's different from what they're saying. This is where we want the focus to be. And yeah, I think they missed the mark on this one. I think to an extent they missed the mark on Wii. On GameCube, it worked, but it's a difficult balance to strike if you want to go out on your own and say, this is what we want to show off as gaming. And unless you're going to be real conservative, and I think, you know, you look at both the Xbox One and the PS4 controllers, they're both fairly conservative. If you want to do something that's not conservative, you've still got to really make sure you cater to every other, you know, to more generalized styles of gaming. And that's hard if you're, you know, as the letter implies, designing it for this game.
Yeah, but they don't.
Right. So
they don't actually design the controllers around single games. But it'd be nice if you, I mean, it should, I think at the very least, the gamepad was designed to fit with the platform, right?
Sure.
So, I mean, they had an idea for, here's what we kind of want people to be doing with this system. Not the kinds of games they're going to play, but here's the kind of experience that we want people to have. And I think the gamepad was built around that.
Right. But I think that led to some misses, ultimately.
Yeah, sure. They missed a few things. Yeah.
So, I don't know. This is a hard question to do if you don't have ideas in front of you. And we could come up with some ideas. And I think
Tough call because you really don't know what direction Nintendo is really heading in with their next console and handheld. I mean, it's at a point where it's very hard to predict. You don't know really. They have to shake something up, and you don't know how that's going to happen.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's always questions of like, is this the best way we have on a console controller to handle movement in 3D space? And I mention that because there's always some games still fuck that up pretty bad. And I think partially because it's kind of a hard thing to map to a control stick.
Yeah. Well, I think one lesson out of this current generation of looking at both the Xbox One and the gamepad is that you can have, you know, really good ideas and even execute them fairly well, but there's always the risk of it not really resonating with the consumer base.
Right.
And so you need to be careful of putting so many resources in one direction that you're sacrificing to, I mean, in Xbox's case, it was extra price, right? It was $100 more. And
people
Nintendo's case, it was, they chose to scale back some of the processing power. And while I think you do need to have that trade-off and you definitely want something innovative, you gotta be, Nintendo should be careful not to do something that's so, out of the mainstream, and that it somehow is putting them at a disadvantage.
Well, don't be radical for the sake of being radical.
Whatever they decide to do, no matter how, I hope it's extremely innovative, but mm-hmm. they've got to be better at explaining it to people. Well, that's the biggest issue for, it's not that Wii U does anything that's so radical that people just can't wrap their minds around it. It's just Nintendo just didn't bother to figure out how to even explain it to people. It was pathetic.
To explain it to anybody, consumers, third parties, anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, it remains part of the question of they haven't really figured out how to use it themselves in ways where people are going, that's cool. That's gamepad. I mean, off TV is great, but there's nothing that's like, this is the definitive gamepad video game experience.
Off TV is weird because I do think they should emphasize it a lot more than they have because it is kind of a magical feature. It was maybe like a very modestly magical feature, but like it is awesome. Mm-hmm. But it's if not- they push that, then it makes you wonder, okay, but when I'm playing on the TV, why do I still have to use this big honking thing?
Right.
It serves me no good if I'm playing on the TV, which I will probably do the majority of the time, or at least some people will prefer to do that most of the time.
I mean, I do. It doesn't strike me as a feature that I'm looking at and going, oh, that right there is why I need a Wii U.
It is one of those things that you have to experience it in your own home, I think, or at least in a friend's home before you really appreciate how nice it is to have. You know, it's hard to make a commercial around off TV play, I think, but you know, they haven't even tried. Maybe they should try.
To me, the most promising feature is still the idea of having two different points of view or having the gamepad being kind of a second window into the game's world. But they haven't really been good at doing that in the full game. I think the best examples of that are still, again, Game & Wario minigames, Shield Pose and Taxi.
I think the co-op, local co-op with different, without split screen, I mean, that's huge. Just some stuff like, you know, the Sonic Racing game. But you could do so much more with that kind of thing where they're just, you know, it's co-op.
Or have some kind of game where, you know, one person has to protect the other person or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, which they did in Nintendo Land. They did that with the Zelda minigame.
Metroid. But
I think if you're looking at a single game where one person is supposed to be keeping up with the two screens and looking back and forth or like being aware of both simultaneously, it's so easy to make that really difficult and hard for people to juggle. And in a sense, you're making games way more complicated when you try to implement that as a main feature.
They actually sort of had fun with that with the Wii U demo with the cameras. Like, they basically were saying, look, you can't manage all of these views at one time. But that's sort of the appeal of the game, is that you need somebody else to help you out and manage this just unwieldy amount of information we're presenting you with.
Yeah. It was a smart recognition of the limitations of that design, but also a social way to solve that problem.
Right, to take that limit and make it a gameplay concept.
Exactly, yeah. Okay, well, that's all the time we have this week for emails. We'll get to more next time, I promise. But the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We will get to Star Fox and other fun emails next time, and maybe to yours as well. So please do write in. Before we go, I want to thank TYP for being with us. And Mike, why don't you plug your fantastic podcast?
Sure. I'm host of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, which is a Nintendo platform-themed, video game, contest. But it's a game where you listen to music and from games, and you try to figure out what game it's from.
Yep.
And then we talk about
that.
It's
really hard.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah, well... It is. I sometimes trick people too with certain songs, but
it's especially hard when you're also on the show, because there's a lot of pressure and it makes you feel super stupid because you're like, I've played this. I know this. What the hell is this? Yeah, it's great. It's a lot of fun, and you can play along at home, and then you'll find out the answer immediately. So
yeah. So, check that out. You can find it on iTunes, or just go to NintendoWorldReport.com and you can find it there.
We have it about
once a month. And we often have folks from RFN on.
There's like over 120 episodes, and they never age. Like it's a perfect archival show, because it's not about current events or current topics or anything. It's a mixture of new games and old games, and eventually they just all become old games, and the music is still good. So it's a show that you can always go back and listen to the full archive and enjoy it fully, I think. So please do that. We've all been on it, of course, and lots of other people you'll recognize and maybe not have been co-hosts on the show. One more thing, we just had a brand new episode of the Famicast go up, and that's always fun. So if you haven't listened to the Famicast, it is a show in the style of RFN, but made in and about Japan. And gaming, being a gamer in Japan. It's in English, so you don't need to know Japanese to listen to it. But it's about mostly Japanese games, I think. Sometimes it's like a good preview, because they're things that are coming to the West eventually, but not haven't yet. So you can hear about them first on the Famicast. And those guys are a lot of fun, really funny. They just started a new feature this episode where the crazy Ty Sugar has a list of games or descriptions of games, and the other guys on the show have to figure out whether they're actual weird Japanese games or if Ty made them up, and it's very hard to tell the difference. So I'm hoping that's going to become a regular feature, because it's really funny, and it's also informative, I guess, if you like learning about crazy ass Japanese video games that will never leave Japan ever, and I know I do. So if you're subscribed to Radio for Nintendo, you should already have the episode. I just hope you'll listen to it. If you're not subscribed, you should. But if you're intent on not subscribing, you can find the Famicast also over at Nintendo World Report. So that's it. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll be back next time.
Later.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.